You're listening live to the first official episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local politicians. Is the volume not good? Bringing you interviews with the local politicians, activists, policy experts, everyday people from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Arman Rana. And
I'm Akil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 25th of February, at 5.09 p.m. We're broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hungbian-speaking Musqueam people.
How's your week been? You are not getting audio in your mic? I don't think that's a problem. You can use the monitors.
I can't hear you.
Yeah, that's okay. You can just use the monitor. But yeah, so how's your week been?
I had a great week right until I was asked by my boss to go put on my cowboy hat and go to Alberta. How about you?
I had a fantastic week, but it's no time for chit-chat because it's showtime. Really excited for this wide-ranging discussion that we're about to have with our guests, mental health, provincial politics, and much more. Who are we going to have on?
Yeah, so a bit of background on our fantastic guest today. So firstly, Hugh Chan has worked in a volunteer capacity in foreign policy lobbying, as well as on David Eby's leadership campaign for the BC NDP. He also worked on the Forward Together campaign in Vancouver with a primary focus on Dulcie Anderson's city council campaign, as well as informally advising some Hong Kong diaspora organizations on Canadian politics. Lastly, he served on a nonpartisan basis on the Vancouver Point Grey and Vancouver Quadra constituency youth councils. Oh, yeah. And I forgot to mention, he was still in high school. Arman, you've known our other guest for a long time. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so he's actually my high school teacher, Mr. Yetman or John Yetman. And I recall us having so many vibrant discussions and arguments in his class. And I learned so much about provincial politics, especially from him and from those discussions. So I'm really looking forward to catching up with him. And he's also Hugh's teacher right now, so which also makes this interesting.
Yeah, we're really bringing this full circle here.
Yeah, for sure. First question for you, Hugh. Thanks so much for coming on. Could you, first of all, are your headphones working okay?
Oh, my headphones are perfectly working fine. Don't worry about me. Okay. I am good to go.
Okay, fantastic. So how are you doing aside from your headphones being okay? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Aside from my headphones being okay, I think generally I've had a pretty good week. You know, been put through the gauntlet a bit by AP statistics. I'm terrible at math, but aside from that, I think I've had a fairly good week, and I'm also just currently working on some data and analysis projects for just my own casual leisure and fun.
Yeah. So how did you get into politics at such a young age, and you know, what was that experience being like for you?
Oh, it's a long story that on average, I've measured, on average, every time I have to brief someone about it, it takes at least 45 minutes, which is almost three quarters the length of the show. So I'm just going to keep it short and sweet. Actually, for me, how I got into politics was really that I was kind of thrown into it, really. I'm from Hong Kong. I experienced the whole pro-democracy movement there. And so I think really from a young age, I've learned the power of social activism as well as the importance of showing up to things. So when I came to Canada in 2020, I threw myself in the same way because I wanted to have a chance to make an actual impact. And one thing led to the other. I kept showing up. And as a result, I somehow landed my way head first into the weirdest and strangest political opportunities that I've ever had. And considering the fact that I've only gotten myself into crazier situations with every year, I shudder at the thought of what's coming next.
Yeah, really looking forward to diving into some of those crazy situations. Mr. Yetman, you've had a colorful life, as I recall. I'm curious, what motivated you to become a social studies teacher of all the things in the world to do with your life?
Well, that was sheer coincidence. It was a motorcycle accident, actually, that led me to it. I was actually studying to be an anthropologist and with some psychology in the background. And I didn't know if I, after the accident, I didn't know if I was going to be able to walk because anthropology, you do your PhD, you might have, it was cultural anthropology. I didn't know where I'd be. And so then I took the Campbell Strong Interest Inventory, and it came up with high school social studies teacher, which I thought very strange because my high school career was less than stellar.
That's so funny. And so, you had a lot of, there's very certain perspectives in politics, I recall. Is there any, like, key moments in your life besides, you know, this motorcycle accident that kind of led you to the perspectives you hold today?
Well, in university, the group I was with, we were from various faculties, and we're still close friends to this day. But we would start each day by reading the paper, reading the political aspects of it. And back then it was the dark days of the social credit government. And Von Palmer and Keith Baldry had large sections of the paper. And that eventually dwindled. But I remember in the 80s, we would start by digesting what was going on in provincial politics and trying to understand. Well, again, it was also the Cold War, so there was a lot going on. We had Reagan in the States, so there was lots of things to get active about. Apartheid in South Africa. There were many things that were engaging our train of thought. So,
yeah, super interesting. So, you know, you mentioned apartheid South Africa. You mentioned Hong Kong. I had a question for you, Hugh. You know, like specifically, like what was it about the situation in Hong Kong that, you know, energized you? And what could you just share a bit more about your experience there? As probably an even younger person than you are now going through that.
Well, I think a lot of it was the fact that I was sort of 9 years old at the time, so there really wasn't a lot I could do besides simply showing up to things and also...
So you would show up to things, yes, as a nine-year-old?
Yes, I would show up to things as a nine-year-old. But apart from that, what I mostly did was really just like keep an eye on the evening news. And while the 2014 Umbrella Movement eventually petered out, however, what happened afterwards was that that essentially provoked and ignited my interest in how the world works, and I threw myself into reading about the Syrian Civil War at the age of 10. Not a good start, but we're getting there. So I really think that a lot of it just really comes down to the fact that Hong Kong was my age at the time, and the fact that I felt like I couldn't do much led me to essentially read a lot and try and learn as much as possible about a topic, so that when I eventually had to approach something, I could do it with like a lot of knowledge and impress people and make a really good impression. Quick tip for if you're going to business or politics: for the love of God, read someone's Wikipedia page 10 minutes before you go into an interview with someone. You will know so much about them and you will have so much information about them that so long as you don't go overboard, it'll go good.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, I don't have a Wikipedia page, so you couldn't read anything about myself or Akil.
Everyone has an Instagram page.
Okay. But yeah, cool. That's super interesting. So thanks so much. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand and Akil show. You'll be hearing more from Akil momentarily on CITR 101.9 FM. We're speaking to Hugh Chan and John Yetman from University Hill Secondary School. After the break, we're going to be speaking about mental health in schools. Stay tuned for that. And yeah, talk to you after the break.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Smash the dirty red scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate him!
You
know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And all the passengers were drunk and insane.
But
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder. Portland, Oregon-based Sub Pop recording artists Quasi are set to perform in Vancouver on Thursday, March 2nd at Fox Cabaret with special guests Number 2. Tickets available now at f7entertainment.com.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
You want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing health care, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to CTR 101.9 FM. This is the Armand and Akil Show. We are talking to Hugh Chan and John Yetman of University Hill Secondary on mental health in schools. Some listeners may find the next section a bit distressing.
Hugh, there was an incident at University Hill last year. Would you be comfortable sharing what happened broadly?
Yes. So essentially what went down was that, as far as most of us can tell, someone self-harmed in the boys' bathroom right before winter break. And the news spread fast, so everybody's pretty sure it happened. And considering the fact that we saw ambulances, we know that it happened. But beyond that, we don't know much for the details, partly because none of us really wanted to pry about such a morbid incident, but also that the school really didn't give us that much information beyond just a notice the day after, I believe, about how the school cares about or the mental health of its students. I believe that's everything that went down. And for what it's worth, I do think the student who tried that is okay now. So, yeah.
That's good to hear. John, I'd like your thoughts on that, on what happened and what a response to that looks like as an educator.
There's a lot that I cannot discuss, but
of course,
just be aware that the teaching staff are always aware and always attempting to do the best we can for the mental well-being of our students. We're trying to create a safe environment, both intellectually, physically, and mentally, because again, these kids are under a lot of stress these days. And again, we are, you know, teaching staff as well are under a lot of stress trying to navigate our way and trying to make it as trying to facilitate their journey through this period of their lives. And it is it can be at times a daunting task.
I guess that segues into another question. Like, what role do you think educators play on promoting mental well-being in students beyond just workload or, you know, classroom considerations? How involved a role do you think an educator should have in ensuring that someone in your care has, you know, about their mental well-being?
Well, educators are, it's not a 9-to-5 job. If we find a student in distress outside of the school community, outside of the work environment and such, we are still on. We are still there and we are still responsible for their care and well-being. And we go out of our way to try to make it as safe an environment as we can. It is, you know, and you're dealing with so many individuals, so many different stories, so many different journeys that these kids are coming through, and trying to navigate through all this through an academic environment that is at many times extremely stressful. Our school, we are one of the top schools in BC, and that pressure is felt by the students, and it can be often, unfortunately, very overwhelming. So we try to mitigate ameliorate the pressure that they're under by giving them alternatives. I'm fortunate because I teach psychology, and I'm always stressing the fact that psychology is helping to reduce anxiety in the classroom and in life. And I hope to give them tools that they can use to better understand the fact that they're going through these issues. And I think one of the most important things is, though, not to downplay whatever they're going through, because for them, for outsiders, it may seem trivial, but for them, it can be incredibly profound. And so I'm always trying to make sure that they understand that these emotions, these situations, these are valid, and they need to find ways that they can safely navigate through them.
So, Hugh, what are some unique challenges that your generation faces when it comes to mental health?
Well, not to be trite, but I do believe that social media does contribute at least to some degree about it. And it's not so that, and it's not as much about the whole fear of missing out thing. It's more so that there's this constant ongoing stream of news that's essentially being sent or recommended to you on, say, a For You page on TikTok, or just from organizations that you follow because you want to stay informed. But as someone who doesn't do politics for a living but comes pretty close considering how much time I spend on Twitter, it's not a problem. I think that the really important bit is that people need to know that sometimes it's okay to take a step back and disconnect, that the world isn't literally going to burn down if you just set some time out for yourself where you just aren't paying that much attention to the news, because a part of why the world feels like it's burning down, the world feels like so much more chaotic than it did, apart from truly international factors, there's also the fact that simply we have more access to more information compared to any other period of history ever. There are places where we didn't even know existed, where we didn't even know people lived in 100 years ago, that we can now get information about. We can now get information about online. So I feel like it's really important to just realize that it's not so that the world's gotten worse. It's just that you're getting more information from more places, and some of that information, because of how news media is designed, they'll report on the most important stories, and some of them will not be pleasant, because that's how the news works.
So it's ripe for doom scrolling, and the landscape is basically lends more. It allows you to see more of the world. So the world hasn't gotten necessarily worse, but you're just seeing more of it for really what it is.
Well, the world has gotten worse in some ways, but I feel doom scrolling is truly a severe problem when it comes to how you can get more information about more things, and that just really amplifies the sort of stress that some of us may feel under about the whole general state of things, beyond the usual teenage melodrama that, for the record, looks nothing like whatever the CW is producing right now.
John, that's it. Actually, that leads me to an interesting question for you. Having been an educator for a long time, have you seen a difference in the past decade as from before as an educator on the kind of problems students are facing and how they kind of deal with those issues?
It would be naive to say that no, that kids are the same,
right.
But their struggles are similar. But they just have more access, of course, to information and such. The digital age is, I'm a digital immigrant myself, so I haven't been born into this as these young people have. And it's, it's similar in many ways in the sense that they're still going through struggles. They're still trying to understand their world around them and such. But it's they're becoming more exposed, I think, and we're seeing that, especially in the realm of law. I'm fortunate to have the Allard School of Law come in and talk to my students about things like consent in the digital age and such, because these are things that are challenging our understanding of our social political environment, and we need to be aware of it as adults and educators. We have to be able to help them navigate this new construct, but they are far more savvy about this stuff than I am.
So you'd say that teenagers have the problems that teenagers have had for time immemorial. The ways some of them have changed, maybe some of them are accentuated by social media.
I remember this anthropology teacher I had. She was funny. She was talking about how they found these tablets in Mesopotamia, and the architect had some room at the bottom, and he'd scribbled, I worry about the youth today. All they want to do is drink wine, chase women, and race chariots. So I think the youth they will overcome this. They are still going to go through the things that they go through. It's just it looks different from our perspective. Because it is so digital, because it is so multimedia, and it's so wireless in ways that we've never understood before. But the troubles, I think that the struggles are so similar.
I actually wanted to circle back to something you said earlier about, you know, the particular school, university that I went to, and both of you are right now, about, you know, the academics and the stress associated with that. I know ABC Vancouver, the current party that has a majority in the school board, is supporting, you know, more kind of emphasis on honors classes and kind of a tired education system. You know, what I just wanted to get, you know, what is your perspective on that? And do you think, like, I can see their advantages and disadvantages, but what are your perspective on honors classes?
I'm getting into an area that I don't think I really am comfortable.
Okay. Well,
discussing.
What is Hugh's perspective?
There maybe? We go. That might.
I think for me, my thoughts on honors class, and keep in mind that this is someone who has never taken a single honors class, so take it with a pinch of salt. That's about the size of whichever place they filmed The Last Jedi's final battle in. I would say that I'm not necessarily opposed to the concept of honor classes themselves. I feel like they can serve a time and place. However, what I'm worried about is that it will cut into the original larger funding for the rest of a school's programs. So I feel like this is a layman coming from someone who has no idea how the school board does its budgeting. Remember, I'm 17. So as a result, I feel that what needs to do is just maybe set aside a portion of the budget that's specifically dedicated towards honors, and then have the rest of it for the rest of the students. And hell, put a lockbox around it. Do what Al Gore did with Social Security.
Yeah, but I was just thinking more culturally. Like, that's what I was wondering. Like, do you feel like culturally, do you notice? Okay, no. I didn't notice that much at that time, but I'm just thinking, like, do you notice culturally that it causes some like more stress or like just divisions in the students? Like imagine if even more of your classes were segregated into honors and regular.
Well, culturally, most of the people in our school, I will be completely honest, and I love every single one of them with my entire heart, are quite academically focused, which is my polite way of saying that we're mostly nerds. But that aside, I do believe that honors classes already sort of exist in a form where people already apply into AP courses where you have to meet like a certain mark requirement for that. And but that being said, I do feel like there's some distinction to be drawn between advanced placement and honors classes, but I just can't directly nail it down yet. Yeah. So I'm afraid I can't talk too much about it.
Yeah, cool.
We're going to take another quick break, but do stay tuned. We're going to get their thoughts on David Eby and the Forward Together campaign after this break.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Smash the dirty red scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate him! I hate him!
Okay, well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder. Portland, Oregon-based Sub Pop recording artists Quasi are set to perform in Vancouver on Thursday, March 2nd at Fox Cabaret with special guests Number 2. Tickets available now at f7entertainment.com.
This is a message from RScientia, a research cluster here at UBC. RScientia is a partnership between the Stuart Blusson Quantum Matter Institute, the Department of Physics and Astronomy, and the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery. RScientia brings together artists and scientists to foster new methods of knowledge exchange that cross the boundaries of art, science, and pedagogy. This spring, RScientia is hosting artist talks with our current cohort of artists in residence. These talks, hosted at the Blusson QMI, will feature three artists who are currently working closely with the QMI, Physics and Astronomy, and Belkin to create sculptural, graphic, and written works. You can stop by to catch our first talk, which will be happening Tuesday, February 21st at 2 p.m. in room 311 at the Quantum Matter Institute. It'll be hosted by J.G. Mayer, who is a Vancouver-based multidisciplinary artist and media designer who specializes in mixed media, web, and audio. Mayer has been working in the areas of both traditional and digital contemporary art and is a sound designer for various game studios who develop titles for publishers such as Apple, Electronic Arts, Microsoft, and Netflix. As part of his talk, Mayer will present one of his major works called Chroma Chamber, a web-based new media art installation that investigates human expectations of vision and machine algorithms by programmatically collating real-time Google image results to surround the viewer with distilled color of the words they speak. You won't want to miss out on this experience at the intersection of both art and science. And stay tuned for our next two talks, which will be happening on March and April.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand and Akil show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are continuing our conversation with John Yetman and Hugh Chan off University Hill Secondary School. Mr. Yetman, I recall being in your class, the election in which now Premier David Eby, but at that time was just a random person, defeated the incumbent Premier, Christy Clark, in the riding of Point Grey, where we are right now. And yet she went on to win the premiership in the end. I remember you had like been a strong supporter of David Eby for many years and was not too much of a fan of Christy Clark at that time. What is your perspective, you know, on how David Eby has evolved as a politician over the last 10 years and how he's been doing in the first 100 days as premier?
David Eby, I've always been I used to watch or read about David Eby when he was with the Pivot Legal Society. He was always such a strong advocate for homeless and for issues that really mattered to average citizens of British Columbia, the people outside of the Carisdale elite. And he has always been a strong advocate. He's a man of great intellect and a man of great compassion. And when he became MLA in my riding, I was quite excited. I don't follow sports. Politics is my sport, which is often a blood sport. And it was exciting to see him. And my students know my bias, but I don't encourage them to follow my bias because I come by my biases authentically. As you probably remember in law class, I would give people bonus marks for working for any political campaign, because I want young people to get involved in our political system, our democracy. You know, we think it is, you know, it's sacrosanct, but we can lose it. And we have to be very careful. We have to be as passionate about the people who are putting into office that to lead us as we are about whether the Canucks win or lose. It's because these are the people that make a difference in our lives. These are the people that can transform our society. I'm a fan. I'm from the Dave Barrett generation of compassion. He transformed our province in ways that were just that brought me into that sphere of politics like nothing else. He made it possible. He invested in children by making it easy to go to post-secondary school, which I took advantage of. He saw that equity is important in our society because it's not the slash and burn mentality of the old Socreds.
For our listeners, could you just give some history? Like, who is Dave Barrett? And
so Dave Barrett was the premier in the 70s, and he was an NDP. He didn't last very long.
3 years.
But his time in office was transformative. He created the ALR, realizing that we can't eat money, realizing that the agricultural land reserve was a way to protect land for future generations. He created my first, like I'm from a very poor background, and he made it. I had my first year of college was 60% grant and 40% student loan, because he understood that is how you reach an equitable society. David Barrett was he gave us an incredible. He created ICBC, which at the time before the right wing sort of got in and dismantled it. We had the cheapest insurance in Canada and the best insurance. He looked at the essential services as being property of all British Columbians. And so Dave Barrett just, he transformed my life. He got me from a place of you know, speculative jobs and such to a career where I'm a functioning member of society. So
yeah, so coming back to David Eby, you mentioned Pivot Legal, and you know there is a sense that you know in some quarters that he's kind of had to sell out in some way to reach where he is. For example, here's a quote from somebody from Pivot Legal. They say he had made some comments about involuntary medical treatment and. This is Meenakshi Menon. She says, coercing people or forcing them into carceral settings for care does not actually engender good results. And this is in response to his comments. So do you feel like, you know, he's had to, like, how do you view that perspective? Do you think he's sold out in some way or changed in some way? Or is he still the activist that he was 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, no, I still believe he is very much an activist as before. The issue is when he came into office, especially the premiership, even John Horgan before him, they came in with basically a dumpster fire left over by the previous government. ICBC was in shambles because they treated it like their own private piggy bank. David Eby was able to turn that around and he was able to make it actually function again. The previous government gave away Crown land to developers. And we never saw any return on that investment. And David Eby was dealt quite a crappy hand. And what he's done with it, I think he should be applauded for it because he's been able to grow our province in the midst of all of this this mess that he inherited. And he is like we have a surplus in government now. He's proactive in a lot of things. And so you're always going to find people of special interest groups who are more tied into one specific issue than another. And they will always find fault. And, you know, and David Eby, he at least is responsive. That's the thing. He won't lock the constituency doors to avoid confrontation. He is open. He's out with the public. And he will listen to people. He will do town halls. And I've been to them. And he will take the criticism and face-to-face. The previous governments never did that. And so I think whatever David Eby is doing, and if he's failing in some areas, I don't consider them failures, but I consider them to be learning opportunities for him, and I know he will.
Yeah. So, Hugh, you worked on David Eby's campaign to some degree. Just what are your impression? What's your impression on how things have evolved and generally, what was that experience like for you?
I think for me the first thing is that with these sort of leadership campaigns, they all usually begin hush hush, but used because once you're partially in like sort of I won't call myself in a circle because I'm not. I was 17. I'm a high schooler. That would be ridiculous. I was on the outer circle of things, outer circle of EB world. You know how Obama had like his own like circle of advisors like Axelrod and Proof, and he called them Obama world. I'm just making EB world.
Like EB now. World. Okay.
Yeah. So what happened?
You heard it here first.
Yeah. So what happens really with these campaigns is that it's a chance for people to have an opportunity to like see what they can do. And for me, what I usually did was just that I usually just kept an eye on Chinese language media and sent some reports back to the central team because I felt like it was important for them to have a good idea as to what the conversation was about them in terms of what they thought of his policies. For example, I know that there's been some positive reception at least in regards to the housing action part because something that's interesting about British Columbian politics so far is that I've seen that there's been for example EB's at like 49%, Polyev's at 36% in the most recent polls across the entire province. So I feel like there's some crossover there where people aren't attached to a political identity. And I'm not like completely attached to a political party either. What they like to see are people who will take action. And in my perspective, EB is someone who does that. But I think the thing that really built my impression of him was the recent settlement with the Blueberry River First Nation, because he broke legal precedent instead of taking them to court and having a lengthy drawn up battle with them over land claims. What he did was that he decided that
Just could you set the scene a bit more about this conflict for our listeners?
Yes. So essentially, the Blueberry River First Nations, I believe, are essentially a First Nations band that lives in the interior, and they've had conflicts with the British Columbian government over resource projects that began with, I believe, Christy Clark, but carried over to the Hogan and now the EB administrations. So what he's done is that essentially he's signed an agreement with the First Nations instead of taking them to court and having a lengthy battle as usually ensues when there's some sort of land claims conflict. And now essentially there's been this genuine innovative partnership that's being created up there, and I feel like that's a comparatively small thing compared to other things he's done, but I feel like that's really, really important because it shows who he is and it shows that he's willing to take innovative solutions to face old problems.
I actually want to touch on something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned that, in the Chinese language media, things can be portrayed very differently. And actually, I've seen this a lot, just even with U.S. election, talking to relatives about, the Trump campaign, how it's portrayed in, Indian language media, WhatsApp groups. Could you just, do you have more specific examples of that? Like, have you encountered examples where things were just portrayed in a very maybe negative light or that unexpectedly?
What can I say about this topic? I can talk about a more general perspective on this. For example, when it comes to language, when it comes to minority language media, I feel like that's something that that a lot of political parties need to work on, because what is tangentially related here is how I helped ghostwrite the EB Lunar New Year speech, and it was in Mandarin, and it was like 1 minute, and he went on, and I had like 10 minutes of prep time in the community center to just coach him.
So just sort of hear that correctly. Yes. You helped ghostwrite David Eby's Chinese New Year speech.
It wasn't the one on the government website, but it's the one that he delivered to the local Chinese community.
To the community center.
UBC. And so he had 10 minutes, and I had to patiently walk him through how to correct some of the more egregious errors, and then
because we know David Eby's been learning Mandarin.
He did learn bits, but it just Dave, if you're listening, there's still room for improvement. That's why I'll leave it at. But no, so he went on stage and he showed up and he talked to all of them in Mandarin. And I spent my entire time there just having my head in hands. But the thing is, they applauded him for it because he showed up in their language. And I feel like that's something that a lot of politicians forget. The basic rule of politics is showing up. It's going to these events, it's learning what their concerns are. And I feel like when it comes to language media, the same argument also applies. You have to make connections there. You have to make yourself available. Because even if you can't speak their language the best way, if you make sure to spend some time, if you spend some time with them, if you also learn to understand what issues the community is interested in, I feel like that can really improve like coverage of a person. And I believe that tying this back into potential bias from potential bias or skewed reporting, I feel like when it comes to sort of ethnic language media, I feel like a lot of it really is just that they simply sometimes the connections aren't made or some groups have written off as like having wrong opinions. When I think that's quite frankly a patronizing view. Sometimes you need to just sit down and talk to people, and I feel like that would go a long way to addressing some of the more complex and controversial parts of policy that are being covered in perhaps an unfavorable light to some politicians or some governments. General advice to Justin Trudeau, if you're listening.
tonal languages are difficult for those of us who didn't learn any growing up. You worked on the Forward Together campaign, which was former Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart's party. What was your involvement?
I primarily worked in simply data entry, but apart from that, I also served in the unofficial role that I believe never got a name, so I'll give it one now. Pestering campaign managers with the uninformed opinions of a 16-year-old about what I think how a campaign should run. I think what I mostly did, apart from the data analysis, was that I just really busted my butt up and down Kitsilano knocking on doors, because no matter how fancy schmancy the sort of the sort of digital age of politics, or the sort of strategy, the sort of technology that parties have been using, like the liberals have their fancy vote identification apps. Nothing beats just simply showing up in front of someone's door and attempting to have a conversation. It may not be a good conversation. It may not even be a conversation. You might just get someone's dog angrily barking at you for a good 5 seconds, and then you slowly walk away, realizing that the person isn't there. So what you do is that... So, yeah, I essentially did get barked at by quite a few dogs. I also dragged a few of them, and I also let the people at the Central Campaign know when there were, like, special, like, community events within, like, certain ethnocultural groups.
But the important thing is that you showed up, you knocked on those doors, and you tried to have a conversation, even if only to be met by a dog's barks.
Yes, yes.
That's actually a great segue. I was going to ask, my next question was, from your perspective, you know, as you said, I think incorrectly, an uninformed 16-year-old, what went wrong with the campaign? You know, it's very rare for incumbent mayors, just for our listeners, Hugh just stretched his hands getting ready to answer this question. It's very rare for incumbent mayors to lose, and so badly as well. So what went wrong?
I feel like what went wrong was... Well, first off, explaining the more macro perspective here, Vancouver City Council did not have a majority for the entirety of 4 years of Kennedy Stewart. You had a splinter, you had the NPA splinter into three different parties, one which was just a Melissa DeGenova's personal vehicle, one which was just a Colleen Hardwick going off into a NIMBY nonsense land, and then Rebecca Bly-Sarah...
You mean team by that? By
yes.
Yeah, team.
Rebecca Bly-Sarah Kirby-Young and... Lisa Dominato. Yeah. They went and joined ABC. And then on the other end, you had the three Greens and 1-1 City, and then there's Swanson with Cope. So I feel like that really contributed to a lot of the gridlock, and Kennedy Stewart built himself as someone who knew how politics worked, knew how government worked, but unfortunately when faced with a situation where the City Hall had more political parties than the parliament which he previously served in, I do feel like that was a rough hurdle to cross. That being said, I feel like something that's generally commendable about the ABC campaign is that they were good. Like, say what you will about their politics, but they ran a fantastic campaign on a purely technical perspective. Here's what they did. They started early in January, so they began their ground game earlier than us, and also, they made time and effort to reach out in many of the ethnic minority communities that supported Gregor Robertson in 2008, 2011, 2014, but then splintered into maybe voting for Y Young in like 2018. So then in 2022, there were a bunch of voters who were essentially floating around, not really knowing what was going on. So then ABC just went in, steamrolled, put ads everywhere. I swear to God, Ken Sim's face was on every bus stop I saw. It was like that meme from one of the Spider-Man movies where Peter Parker's just saying, "Everywhere I go, I see his face," but with any of the ABC council candidates. So they had the name recognition advantage that they built in early. They had a technology advantage. They had an excellent campaign manager, Kareem Alam, who also ran Kevin Falcon's running leadership bid. And meanwhile, the Kennedy Stewart campaign simply just started later and was fundamentally outclassed by the fact that the political winds of change were feeling very anti-incumbent, anti-establishment. A lot of mayors went down in the elections last year, for example. So I feel like it was really a combination of just outside factors and the fact that the campaign just didn't do enough to catch up and didn't simply have anything that inspired people, while ABC just kept hammering their 100 new cops, 100 new nurses message into the ground, as well as the road tax.
Yeah, there was so much more to talk about. We might need to bring you on again, but we're actually coming up to the hour. So that's all the time we have for today. The song, just to give song credit, the song you heard at the beginning, you heard it a bit, Song of the Meese by Sarah Pratt. You can listen to more of her on SoundCloud at Leisure Noise. A few other things to wrap up. You can find us still on CITR News. We're going to have our own kind of social media soon on social media and also the website. We do have a great set of guests lined up for you. Next month, we've got Daniel Francis, same time on March 25th, who's a historian and author of Becoming Vancouver. It was a great read. It's a brisk chronicle of Vancouver, BC, from early days to its emergence as a global metropolis.
I just want to jump in here quickly and say that for those of you who are as arbitrarily interested as we are with the goings-on at City Council, we've got a very special guest lined up for you. Stay tuned for updates on that. And finally, we'd like to thank Hugh Chan and John Yetman for joining the show. Thank you both very much for being here.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Take care, everyone, and have a great evening.